This program is intended for people who are blind at current affairs. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article that we'll read today is an excerpt from The New Anarchy. This is part two of a five-part cover story from the April 2023 issue. And this section is entitled Salad Bar Extremism. If you're looking for a good place to hide an anarchist, you could do worse than Barry, Vermont. Barry, spelled B-A-R-R-E, but pronounced Barry, is a small city in the bowl of a steep valley in the northern reaches of a lightly populated mountainous state. You don't just stumble upon a place like this. I went to Barry in October because I wanted to understand the anarchist who had fled there in the early 1900s, at the beginning of a new century, already experiencing extraordinary violence and turbulence. The conditions that make a society vulnerable to political violence are complex but well established. Highly visible wealth disparity, declining trust in democratic institutions, a perceived sense of victimhood, intense partisan estrangement based on identity, rapid demographic change, flourishing conspiracy theories, violent and dehumanizing rhetoric against the, quote, other, a sharply divided electorate, and a belief among those who flirt with violence that they can get away with it. All of those conditions were present at the turn of the last century. All of them are present today. Back then, few Americans might have guessed that the violence of that era would rage for decades. In 1901, an anarchist assassinated President William McKinley, shot him twice in the gut while shaking his hand at the Buffalo World's Fair. In 1908, an anarchist at a Catholic church in Denver fatally shot the priest who had just given him communion. In 1910, a dynamite attack on the Los Angeles Times killed 21 people. In 1914, in what officials said was a plot against John D. Rockefeller, a group of anarchists prematurely exploded a bomb in a New York City tenement, killing four people. That same year, extremists set off bombs at two Catholic churches in Manhattan, one of them St. Patrick's Cathedral. In 1916, an anarchist chef dumped arsenic into the soup at a banquet for politicians, businessmen, and clergy in Chicago. He reportedly used so much that people immediately vomited, which saved their lives. Months later, a shrapnel-filled suitcase bomb killed 10 people and wounded 40 more at a parade in San Francisco. America's entry into World War I temporarily quelled this violence. Among other factors, some anarchists left the country to avoid the draft, but the respite was far from total. In 1917, a bomb exploded inside the Milwaukee Police Department headquarters, killing 9 officers and 2 civilians. In the spring of 1919, dozens of mail bombs were sent to an array of business leaders and government officials, including Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. All of this was a prologue. Starting late in the evening on June 2, 1919, in a series of coordinated attacks, anarchists simultaneously detonated massive bombs in 8 American cities. In Washington, an explosion at the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer blasted out the front windows and tore framed photos off the walls. Palmer, in his pajamas, had been reading by his second-story window. He happened to step away minutes before the bomb went off, a decision that authorities believed kept him alive. His neighbors, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy and his wife, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, had just gotten home from an evening out when the explosion also shattered their windows. Franklin ran over to Palmer's house to check on him. The following year, a horse-drawn carriage drew up to the pink marble entrance of the J.P. Morgan building on Wall Street and exploded, killing more than 30 people and injuring hundreds more. From these episodes, one name leaps out across time, Luigi Galiani. Galiani, who was implicated in most of the attacks, is barely remembered today, but he was, in his lifetime, one of the world's most influential terrorists, famous for advancing the argument for propaganda of the deed, the idea that violence is essential to the overthrow of the state and the ruling class. Born in Italy, Galiani immigrated to the United States and spread his views through his anarchist newspaper, Cronica Sovversa, or Subversive Chronicle. He told the poor to seize property from the rich and urged his followers to arm themselves to find, quote, a rifle, a dagger, and a revolver. Galiani fled to Bari in 1903 under the name Luigi Pimpino and after several encounters with law enforcement in New Jersey. He attracted disciples, Galianiste, they were called, despite shunning all forms of organization and hierarchy. He was quick-witted, with an imposing intellect and a magnetic manner of speaking. Even the police reports described his charisma. The population of Bari today is slightly smaller than it was in Galiani's day, roughly 10,000 then, 8,500 now, and it is the sort of place that is more confused by the presence of strangers than wary of them. The first thing you notice when you arrive is the granite. There is a mausoleum feel to any granite city, and on an overcast day, the gray post office building on North Main Street gives the illusion that all of the color has suddenly vanished from the world. Across the street at City Hall, I wandered into an administrative office where an affable woman, "You came to Bari? On purpose?" generously agreed to take me inside the adjacent opera house, which, recently refurbished, looks much as it did in the winter night in 1907, when Galiani appeared there before a packed house to give a speech alongside the anarchist Emma Goldman. Galiani almost certainly could have disappeared into Bari with his wife and children and gotten away with it. He did not want that. In his own telling, Galiani's anger was driven by how poorly the working class was treated, particularly in factories. In Bari, granite cutters spent long hours mired in the sludge of a dark, unheated, and poorly ventilated workspace, breathing in silica dust, which made most of them gravely ill. Seeing the town, even a century after Galiani was there, I could understand why his time in Vermont had not altered his world view. In the foreword to a 2017 biography, Galiani's grandson, Sean Sayers, put a hagiographic gloss on Galiani's legacy. He was not a narrow and callous nihilist. He was a visionary thinker with a beautiful idea of how human society could be, an idea that still resonates today. For Galiani and other self-identified communist anarchists like him, the beautiful idea was a world without government, without laws, without property. Other anarchists did not share his idealism. The movement was torn by disagreements. They were anarchists, after all. In Galiani's day, as in our own, the lines of conflict were not cleanly delineated. American radicalism can be a messy stew of ideas and motivations. Violence doesn't need a clear or consistent ideology and often borrows from several. Federal law enforcement officials use the term salad bar extremism to describe what worries them most today, and it applies just as aptly to the extremism of a century ago. When Galiani had arrived in America, he had encountered a nation in a terrible mood, one that would feel familiar to us today. Galiani's children were born into violent times. The nation was divided not least over the cause of its divisions. The gap between rich and poor was colossal. The top 1% of Americans possessed almost as much wealth as the rest of the country combined. The population was changing rapidly, Reconstruction had been defeated, and the South states in particular remained horrifically violent toward black people, for whom the threat of lynching was constant. The Great Migration was just beginning. Immigration surged, inspiring intense waves of xenophobia. America was primed for violence, and to Galiani and his followers, destroying the state was the only conceivable path. The spectacular violence of 1919 and 1920 proved a catalyst. A concerted nationwide hunt for anarchists began. This work, which culminated in what came to be known as the Palmer Raids, entailed direct violations of the Constitution. In late 1919 and early 1920, a series of raids carried out in more than 30 American cities led to the warrantless arrests of 10,000 suspected radicals, mostly Italian and Jewish immigrants. Attorney General Palmer's dragnet ensnared many innocent people and has become a symbol of the damage that overzealous law enforcement can cause. Hundreds of people were ultimately deported. Some had fallen afoul of a harsh new federal immigration law that broadly targeted anarchists. One of them was Luigi Galiani. The law was kind of designed for him, Beverly Gage, a historian and the author of The Day Wall Street Exploded, told me. The violence did not stop immediately after the Palmer raids. In an irony that frustrated authorities, Galiani's deportation made it impossible for them to charge him in the Wall Street bombing, which they believed he planned, because it occurred after he'd left the country. Nevertheless, sweeping action by law enforcement helped put an end to a generation of anarchist attacks. That is the most important lesson from the anarchist period. Holding perpetrators accountable is critical. The Palmer raids are remembered, rightly, as a ham-handed application of police state tactics. Government actions can turn killers into martyrs. More important, aggressive policing and surveillance can undermine the very democracy they are meant to protect. State violence against citizens only validates a distrust of law enforcement. But deterrence conducted within the law can work. Unlike anti-war protesters and labor organizers, violent extremists don't have an agenda that invites negotiation. Today's threats of violence can be inspired by a wide range of ideologies that themselves morph and shift over time, Deputy Homeland Security Advisor Josh Geltzer told me. Now, as in the early 20th century, countering extremism through ordinary debate or persuasion, or through concession, is a fool's errand. Extremists may not even know what they believe or hope for. One of the things I increasingly keep wondering about, what is the end game? Mary McCord, a former assistant U.S. attorney and national security official, told me. Do you want democratic government? Do you want authoritarianism? Nobody talks about that. Take back our country. Okay, so you take it back. Then what do you do? Next, The Obscure Maritime Law That Ruins Your Commute, by Scott Lincecum. What with everything going on in the world, stewing over an obscure, century-old maritime law may seem odd, but the Jones Act really does warrant such consternation. It's not just a terrible law that hurts you, me, and everyone we know, especially if they live in Puerto Rico or drive to work on the East Coast. It's also a cautionary tale against government industrial policies, which can have unintended consequences far beyond high prices or budget overrun. The Jones Act, formerly known as Section 27 of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, was ostensibly intended to ensure adequate domestic shipbuilding capacity and a ready supply of merchant mariners and ships in times of war and other national emergencies. Today, it requires that any domestic waterborne shipping of goods be conducted on vessels that are built, owned, flagged, and crewed by Americans. As a result, the U.S. has one of the most restrictive shipping systems in the world. By effectively barring foreign competitors from transporting goods between U.S. ports, the Jones Act has predictably inflated the cost of shipping and shipbuilding in the United States. That's the law's seen cost, which many of its supporters acknowledge but claim is necessary for ensuring a thriving industrial base and sufficient supply of ships and mariners. But the unseen costs do the most damage and thus swamp any alleged benefits. First, let me put the direct costs in perspective. We're not just talking about a few extra bucks here and there. Building a container ship in the United States costs up to five times as much as it does abroad, and transporting crude oil on a Jones Act tanker can cost three times as much, an ever-expanding price differential driven by decades of insulation from foreign competition. Because ships and shipping are so expensive, few companies use this method outside routes that offer no alternatives, such as between the continental United States and Puerto Rico or Hawaii. Instead, they use land-based transport, mainly trucks and trains, to deliver goods that could have traveled by sea between the approximately 360 U.S. ports to service the 130 million people that live near our 95,000-plus miles of coasts. Many other countries do this kind of short sea shipping. In fact, the Congressional Research Service reports that only about 2% of all U.S. freight is carried by ships, and that, despite the massive growth in coastal U.S. cities since the 1960s, coastwise shipping tonnage actually declined by roughly 44% over the same period. All other modes of freight transport, including international shipping, have either increased or remained steady. Ship American might sound nice in theory. This is what it looks like in practice, not shipping much of anything in America at all. Heightened use of trucks and freight trains means more wear on aging U.S. infrastructure and more traffic, especially on roads running parallel to the U.S. sea lanes. It means a higher risk of accidents involving dangerous materials in or around urban centers, such as the recent propane car derailment near Sarasota, Florida. And it means increased environmental harms because surface transportation emits more carbon and uses more energy than ocean ships and barges. The law thus forces unwitting Northeasterners to be stuck on I-95, surrounded by smog-producing 18-wheelers hauling trailers that could have been traveling between the ports of New York and Boston on compact, low-emission ships that the Jones Act has made cost-prohibitive. The expense of U.S. shipping and shipbuilding thus forces us to waste finite resources, work or leisure time, tax dollars, environmental efforts that could be better used elsewhere. It also denies us many other types of ships. For example, the U.S. has a grand total of zero Jones Act-compliant liquefied natural gas tankers because producing these massive complex vehicles here would be so expensive as to defy any economic sense. Consequently, transporting liquid natural gas in bulk to New England and Puerto Rico is impossible, and these U.S. regions suffer from diminished energy security. Last fall, several New England governors, alarmed by Ukraine-related depletion of local energy inventories, begged the Biden administration for a winter-long Jones Act waiver, and local utilities warned that an unseasonably cold winter would produce rolling blackouts across the region. A lack of LNG, propane, and oil tankers also forces these areas to import energy from Nigeria, Oman, Spain, pre-sanctions Russia, and other faraway places, even as U.S. energy is exported from Texas to China and dozens of other countries. Not only is that economically nonsensical, but it also means higher shipping emissions. The environmental damage does not stop there. The United States lacks specialized wind turbine installations used to build offshore wind projects that meet Jones Act requirements. This means higher project and taxpayer costs, slower wind energy deployment, and diminished progress on climate change. The first Jones Act compliant wind turbine installation vessel is supposed to be delivered in the fourth quarter of 2023 at a substantial cost, but will still need four or five more to meet the U.S. offshore wind goals. No other vessels are in the pipeline. The general lack of Jones Act vessels also inhibits emergency response efforts for Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Alaska, and other U.S. regions without easy land-based access. When Hurricanes Maria and Fiona devastated Puerto Rico in 2017 and 2022, respectively, more than 99% of the world's cargo ships couldn't immediately participate in the relief efforts because they didn't comply with the Jones Act's restrictions. At one point last year, a tanker moving diesel from Texas to Europe rerouted to Puerto Rico to boost the island's depleted fuel supply. But the Jones Act blocked it from offloading this much-needed cargo. The ship finally docked days later, but only after a massive public outcry prodded the Biden administration to issue a legally dubious Jones Act waiver. Bureaucratic delays and bottlenecks are costly annoyances in normal times, but they become life-threatening problems following a natural disaster when every second counts. High cost means not only fewer ships, but also older ones, because they're so expensive to replace. The average age of a Jones Act ship in 2019 was 20 years, more than 7 years older than ships that don't meet the law's requirements. And the previous 15 Jones Act ships that were scrapped had an average age of 43. Having decrepit rust buckets cruising right off the U.S. coast raises more safety and environmental concerns. The Jones Act's unintended harms are even extend to the U.S. shippers and shipbuilders it's supposed to protect. The law encourages American shipyards to turn away from competitive international market and towards a captive but much smaller domestic one. Their reduced output in turn means that high fixed costs are spread across fewer vessels and that economies of scale, volume discounts from suppliers, and specialization are extremely limited. The result is a vicious cycle where prices go up and the quantity demanded goes down, placing further upward pressure on prices. Rinse and repeat until you have the zombie industry we see today. The Philly shipyard offers a troubling example of this cost death spiral. In 2013, the shipping company Matson ordered two container ships from the shipyard for $209 million each. Last year, Matson ordered three of the same ships from the same company for roughly $333 million each. Supporters claim that reforming or repealing the Jones Act would destroy the domestic industry and imperil national security, but all these doomsday scenarios are far-fetched. For starters, government orders account for almost all U.S. shipbuilding output and revenue, and repealing the law wouldn't touch those transactions. The availability of cheaper and better vessels, moreover, would boost domestic demand for coastwise shipping, improving the industry's financial prospects. A recent OECD study estimates, in fact, that nixing the Jones Act would increase domestic shipbuilding output and final value added by hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And it's not like current law is doing a bang-up job of protecting the industry. The Jones Act fleet has dropped from around 250 ships in the 1980s to just 91 today. No use protecting something that's already dead. Industrial policy is once again hot in the United States. Federal subsidies and trade restrictions, fueled by pandemic and China-related security risks and intended to boost strategic commercial industries such as semiconductors and batteries, have proliferated dramatically since 2020. Collectively, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, and the Inflation Reduction Act will funnel hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars to favored companies in the United States, marking one of the biggest U.S. industrial policy pushes since the 1980s. The ribbon-cutting ceremonies and golden shovels that will accompany a commercial project supported by these laws will make for great photo ops and generate lots of political excitement, but the cameras won't catch the invisible knock-on effects and unintended harms. And if the Jones Act is any guide, which really it should be, there's going to be worth stewing over. Now, an ode to small talk by James Parker. The correct answer to the question, how are you, is not too bad. Why? Because it's all purpose. Whatever the circumstances, whatever the conditions, not too bad will get you through. In good times, it projects a decent pessimism, an Eeyore-ish reluctance to get carried away. On an average day, it bespeaks a muddling through modesty. And when things are rough, really rough, it becomes a heroic understatement. Best of all, with three equally stressed syllables, it gently forestalls further inquiry because it is, basically, meaningless. Small talk is rhetoric, too. Americans in particular are small talk artists. They have to be. This is a wild country. The most tenuous filaments of consensus and cooperation attach one person to the next. So you have the have a nice days, the hot enough for yous, the how about those metzes. They serve a vital purpose. Without these emollient little going nowhere phrases and momentary social contract that they represent, the streets would be a free-for-all, a rodeo of disaster. But that's the negative view. Some of my most radiant interactions with other human beings have been fleeting, glancing moments of small talk. It's an extraordinary thing. A person stands before you unknown, a complete stranger, and the merriest little speech morsel can tip you headfirst into the blazing void of his or her soul. I was out walking the other day when a UPS truck rumbled massively to the curb in front of me. As the driver leaped from his cab to make a delivery, I heard music coming out of the truck's speakers, a familiar, weightless strain of blues rock noodle. There was a certain spacey twinkle in the upper registers, a certain flimsiness in the rhythm section. Yes, it had to be. The Grateful Dead in one of their zillion live recordings, and I knew the song. It's my favorite Dead song, China Cat Sunflower, I said to the UPS driver as he charged back to his truck. A huge grin. You got it, babe. The exchange of energy, the perfect understanding, the Freemasonry of deadheadness that flashed instantaneously between us, the most of all honorific babe. I was high as a kite for the next 10 minutes, projected skyward on a pure beam of small talk. Well, we've run out of time today for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a great day.